Maury Wills joins us on Sports Byline. He played shortstop for 14 seasons, primarily with the Dodgers, where he won three World Series, and he also played for the Pirates and Expos. And he was really an essential part of the Dodgers championship teams in the mid-1960s, and he's credited with reviving the stolen base as part of baseball's strategy. He had 585 career stolen bases. He won the National League MVP award and was a seven-time All-Star. And he also managed in the major leagues with the Seattle Mariners. You and I both were born and raised in Washington, D.C. Take me back to that town when you were growing up.
Whoa, Ron. Those were some very, how would I describe those days?
Interesting.
I was born in 1932, so that was during the Depression, right?
Right.
And 13 children, can you imagine? 13 children, eight sisters and four brothers. And which was, you know, it was quite an education growing up with eight sisters and four brothers. I learned to be a gentleman at a young age, that's for sure. And I had three brothers older than I. And they were all good athletes, and I aspired to be as good as they were. We played all the sports, and as a result of aspiring to be as good as they were, I ended up playing with grown men at the age of 15.
Wow!
It was semi-pro baseball. I don't know what semi-pro is. You know, they mixed match uniforms on.
One of the things that I knew about Washington, D.C., it was unique and for the obvious reasons, because it was the nation's capital and it was caught to some degree between the North and the South, if you know what I'm talking about. And I don't know how open-minded it was, but it was probably a very unique experience for an African-American.
Yeah. As I look back, I find it to be kind of unique. But at the time, it seemed normal. We lived over there, here, and they lived over there, and that's just the way it was. The things that stand out was when I went to high school there. I was also a good football player, and we declared ourselves the city champions of Washington D.C., Cardozo High, and. But then there was a white, and the schools were not integrated at the time. So one of the white schools were undefeated also, and they declared themselves city champions. So it turned out that we challenged them to a game to see who the city champions would be. And the Board of Education didn't allow it. That's the only thing that, after all these years, that really sticks out with me about Washington, D.C. But it was a good city. I was born and raised in the projects. We had a little team. Started playing when I was 6 years old. And what happened to me, no future whatsoever. No future. Beans for breakfast, beans for lunch, beans for dinner. Beans, beans, beans. Dad, we having beans again? You better eat those beans, boy. Okay. Lima beans, pork and beans, navy beans, beans, you name it, and we had it. And but it didn't matter. That was no big deal as long as we could play baseball.
Let me interject something here, and that is Cardozo High School. I know it well because, as I said, I grew up for a period of time in Washington. And you were a three-sport athlete. I mean, it was football, baseball, and basketball as well. Tell me, how good was Sal Hall's undefeated 48 team, the football team?
Well, we were undefeated. Let's see.
And you didn't have any points scored against you either.
No, I remember Mr. Hall, Coach Hall. He was just a fantastic person. He's a no-nonsense person, and he was as good a football coach as you'd find in the country. And my older brother one of my older brothers, two of my older brothers went to Cardozo, and the other older brother went to Phelps. I aspired to go to Cardozo, and that's where I ended up going. And I, as you mentioned, I played football, basketball, and baseball. I was a pitcher in baseball. I had 8 scholarships in football. But what happened was, playing on Sundays on this team with older men, they all had a half pint of whiskey in their back pockets. And if they didn't get too drunk Saturday night and they had enough players, they'd have a game on Sunday. And I looked forward to playing with him. And I was 17, 16, and yet I was, they found me good enough to play on their team. And one day, the Washington Senators went out into the community to conduct clinics, baseball clinics. And they sent a player to our playground. His name was Jerry Pretty. Jerry Pretty was a second baseman for the Washington Senators. I'll never forget him. I got to know him more about him when I played for the Dodgers because he was from Pasadena. Jerry Pretty came to our playground, and I was one of the kids there. I was barefooted. I didn't have any baseball shoes. Actually, I never owned a pair of shoes. And I, even when going to school on during the winter times, I had to put cardboard or newspaper in or tissue paper into the shoes to make them fit me because they were my older brother's shoes. But I never really had a pair of my own, so I was there. But it's okay as long as I can play baseball.
Let me interject something else as well. Tell me about, we got a couple minutes before we have to break, but tell me about the game. I know it was 67 years ago, but May 8th, 1950, a game against Phelps, you throw a one-hitter and struck out 17.
Yeah, I seems like I did that a lot. I had a great arm. It was God-given, of course. And my father was a Baptist minister, so I anything that was God-related and spiritual, even today I have a spiritual way of life. I locked into it. That game was, yeah, I guess it was played at Banneker High School field. Not Banneker High School, Banneker Playground Field is on Georgia Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Right across from Howard University.
Right.
And ironically, for the last 5 years at least, and I'll do it again this year, and I'm sure next year too, I have a Maury Wills High School Invitational Baseball Tournament. And all the high schools in the area come to that clinic. And I get a chance to give back what was so freely given to me, a chance to have a life. Because growing up in the projects with beans for breakfast, beans for dinner, one bath in the house, 8 sisters, 4 brothers, 4 and 5 in a bed, not much of a future for a kid. And by the grace of God, baseball gave me that avenue, and I have a beautiful life today.
We've got about 90 seconds before we have to break here, Maury, but how did you end up in the Dodgers organization?
So, Ron, okay, I aspired to be, well, when the Washington Senators sent this player named Jerry Pretty, a second baseman, out to our playground, it was a program that Washington Senators had. I'd never been to a Washington Senator game. It was just a team I'd heard of. Because we aspired to play in the Negro Leagues. That was all we knew growing up. So when Jerry Pretty came out, and I know from the time I was with the Dodgers, they asked us to go out into the community to conduct clinics. I had no problem with that because I remember what Jerry Pretty did for me. He singled me out. And and I was barefooted. And he told all the other kids, he said, "Watch this boy. He's good." And he bounced the ball to me. I got my little feet in place and got my feet apart. I got my hands out in front the way you're supposed to in fielding a ground ball. And took my little crow hop and threw it overhanded and popped his mitt. He said, "Wow, kid." He said, "That's good. How old are you?" I said, "I'm 10. He said, "Well, you keep playing baseball because you got a chance to be a good ball player one day." And from that day on, I aspired to be a major league player. And I thank Jerry Pretty for that. And I give back to youth today. I still go to clinics and conduct clinics with the memory of Jerry Pretty speaking to me at that time when I was about 10 years old.
Maury, hold on just a second. We got to take a break here. Maury Wills is with us, shortstop who played 14 seasons, won 3 World Series championships. We continue on Sports Byline. Maury Wills has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. 14 seasons in the major leagues, of course, most of those with the Dodgers, and he certainly did help them in a big way in winning 3 World Series, one in 1959, another in 63, and another in 65, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. Maury, you began your major league career with L.A. in 1959, and in your first full season in 1960, you hit .295 and led the league with 50 stolen bases. Now, the thing I thought about was you grew up in Washington, D.C. What was the experience like of playing in Los Angeles, which had to be a lot foreign to you in a great sense?
Oh, it really was. When I was growing up in Washington, D.C., in the projects and out in Northeast on Kenilworth Avenue, we didn't even leave the projects. We didn't know unless I was just going to school. And now I'm getting a chance to play professional baseball, and I'm on the other side of the country in California. I've always had an attitude of gratitude, and I'm just grateful that I was blessed with the ability to play baseball and got a chance to play, have a good life.
How did you adjust to the Los Angeles atmosphere, the culture, and the Hollywoodness of it?
By the time I got here to California, I don't know, I think I was about 25. And I had played a number of years, 7-8 years in the minor leagues. I traveled all over the country. It was foreign to me, the culture here. I didn't stay here all year long. I just played baseball in the summer and went back to where I lived, which was Spokane, Washington, is where I raised my family. And I went back to Washington, D.C. at times.
Let me ask you a little bit about your manager, Walter Austin. I know most people think of the Dodgers, think of Tommy Lasorda, unless they do go way back. But Walter Austin was the man with the Dodgers at one point. The first time you met him, what was your impression of him?
I was just happy to be in a major league clubhouse and looking around at the walls and looking at the lockers and things like that and at the floor, which something which was foreign to me because I'd spent 8.5 years in the minors. I wasn't in a frame of mind to have an opinion evaluate him. I was just happy to be there. It turned out, and the longer I was there, the more I got to know him. He's the finest baseball man I've ever known. And he was the one that made me the captain of his team. I became the Dodger captain. After about 4 years there and 8.5 years in the minor leagues, he's one of the most wonderful individuals I've ever met on the planet.
What made him such a good manager then?
Well, because he kept an open mind. At least he expressed an open mind. I'm sure that you didn't want to make him angry, because he could tear up the clubhouse. Really, he was from Dogtown. Ohio, and he was a country boy, so to speak. Strong as an ox, and he would get in your face if necessary. One time, I went into his. I said something to a reporter about him that wasn't complimentary. He called me in his office, and he chewed me out and just scared me to death. And being feisty, I was the captain of the team, so I resigned. So the next day, I sheepishly walked into his office and said, "Skipper, I'm sorry. May I have my position back as the captain of the team?" Walt Austin said, looked me right in the eyes and said, "You never lost it." That's the kind of man he was.
Let's go to 1962 for just a moment, because that was a special year for you. You win the MVP. You steal 104 bases to set a new Major League Baseball stolen base record, breaking the old modern era mark of 96. And that was set by Ty Cobb back in 1915. And you also stole more bases than all of the other teams that year. Let's talk about base stealing. You were always very fast, but there was something extraordinary about your acceleration. How did your base stealing superiority develop?
Okay, it's very simple. It's a good story, too. My last game I played as a minor leaguer was in Phoenix, Arizona, for the Dodgers AAA team from Spokane in the Pacific Coast League. We were traveling. We played in Phoenix. And I'm playing, and I stole about three bases that game and got about three, four hits. I had a good night. I was all over the place. And when the game was over, Walt Austin came up to me and said, "You're going to the Dodgers tomorrow." I said, "I am going to the Dodgers." That was a dream from the time I signed at 17. And I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to take a flight to Milwaukee. I got me a newspaper because I wanted to read about myself. As a baseball player, when you have a good night or a good day playing, the next day you get a newspaper. Because we're all kind of stuck on ourselves. We think we're the catch meow. You have to be that way in order to be good enough to excel. And when I opened the newspaper to the sports section on the plane to read about myself, there was a quote in the column in the paper said, "I like the way that kid slides, Ty Cobb." Ty Cobb saw me play my last game. I got about three hits, stole about four bases, scored about three or four runs. Made some good plays in the field, and Cobb was quoted in the article as saying, "I like the way that kid slides." So I became a fan of Ty Cobb right there, and I wanted to be just like him. I couldn't, because Ty Cobb was 195 pounds, a little over 6 feet tall. And here I am at 5'9½", claiming to be 5'10", claiming to be 170 pounds, but I only weighed about 155. But I was thinking of myself as Ty Cobb. And he inspired, reading his life story inspired me. And when I read that column in the quote saying, "I like the way that kid slides," I got a book on Ty Cobb. And Cobb said that everybody he spiked had it coming. I felt the same way. I was a little guy. When I spiked somebody, I apologized. "Oh, I'm sorry." Cobb would get up and want to punch the lights out. I couldn't do that. I wasn't big enough. So Ty Cobb was my hero. Now, from what I read and heard about Ty Cobb, maybe he wouldn't have liked me. But I didn't identify with him in that way. Identify with him as a baseball player. He was relentless.
Yeah, let me ask you one question. And I know the Dodger fans, when you got on base, would go, "Go, go, go, Maury, go." And while you weren't the fastest runner in the major leagues, that acceleration that I talked about was really kind of the hallmark of your speed. You studied pitchers relentlessly. Did you steal on pitchers primarily on the pitcher or on just your speed and capabilities?
No, I stole on the pitcher. Ron, pitchers got together and came up with all kinds of balk moves and whatever they could get away with to stop me. But I studied them. I watched them when they warmed up. I watched them in the bullpen when they were getting ready for the game, and when somebody else was on base, realizing whether it was a pass runner on first or not, and they were concerned about him stealing a base. And so when I got on the first base, I knew them so well. I knew how they liked their coffee. Even when the Dodgers, my own team, had a pitcher's meeting, I would go in and sit in the meeting just to hear the pitchers talk and explain how they felt about a base holding a potential base stealer at bay. So I was quick and I could run. I was in a lot of baseball races, especially in the minor leagues. Never lost one, but stealing a base is being able to get a good start, accelerating, and you only accelerate from the beginning because you know the pitcher's move. As a frame of mind, too, I eliminated any fear of failing. I was never afraid over there.
Maury, hold on just a second. We got to take a break here. Maury Wills has joined us. We're talking about his career, about his life as well. And again, 104 bases set the new Major League Baseball stolen base record. That was in 1962, and that was the same year he was the MVP. When we come back, we'll talk about his World Series teams as we continue on Sports Byline. Maury Wills has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. Maury playing with the Dodgers primarily during his 14-year career. And while with the Dodgers, he went and played in three World Series and winning three World Series. 1959, you beat the White Sox in six games. What sticks out about that World Series to you, Maury?
Well, in 1959, I was a rookie. And we played in the Coliseum in Los Angeles, we had 110,000 people. And I looked up, which you don't want to do, and look at that many people. You only want to look up one time if you do, because the nerves, you just fall apart knowing that many people are watching. The great Hall of Famer, too, Louis Aparicio, was shortstop for the White Sox, and he was the story of base stealing and playing shortstop, but it just inspired me to want to be as good as he was, and so I remember that very well. The White Sox had Ted Kluszewski at first base. It was an outstanding team, and we won that World Series.
Why did you all win that World Series?
Why? I don't know. I had a good series, but I can't say I was the reason. I guess it was pitching. Sandy Koufax, Johnny Padres, Don Drysdale, the Larry Sherry. We had some great pitching.
Yeah, the Dodgers during that period of time, I think defense and pitching is what they were most notable for. The hitting was mediocre, I think some people have said. Let's move on.
Hey, what do you mean mediocre?
You know what I'm talking about.
It was good enough, wasn't it?
That's it. That's the way to describe it, good enough. Let's go to 1963. Yeah. You go up against the Yankees, and, boy, there was no competition there. You swept the Yankees in four. What happened?
Yeah, well, the Yankees had the great Mickey Mantle and the great Roger Maris. They had Elston Howard behind the plate. Tony Kubek, my friend, at shortstop. Bobby Richardson at second base. We didn't have a chance, did we? Well, good pitching will always stop good hitting. And we had the great Sandy Koufax and the great Don Drysdale and the great Johnny Padres. Johnny Padres, a pitcher that people don't speak much, doesn't speak a lot about, but he was an outstanding pitcher. So good pitching will always stop good hitting. If you were going to build a baseball team, you would start with pitching. You get the best pitchers you can get. And then you go to the catcher and the first baseman, second baseman, shortstop. Then you would go to hitting and you would go to base stealing and base running. Pitching is the name of the game. We had that.
That certainly was the case in 1965 when the Dodgers beat the Twins in the World Series in seven games. And that's the one that a lot of people talk about because it's best remembered. for the heroics of Sandy Koufax, who was named the series MVP, and he would not pitch in Game 1 as it fell on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur. But he did pitch in Game 2, and then he tossed complete game shutouts in Games 5 and 7 with only 2 days of rest in between to win the championship. Now, you're on the field, Maury Wills. You're sitting at shortstop. You have a front-row seat in watching this man pitch in that World Series. What will you always remember about that series and his performance?
It just so happens that as late in the game as the seventh inning, maybe the sixth inning, I was the one that was going to be the MVP of the series with, I think I got about 12 or 13 hits. You find yourself being a spectator playing behind Sandy Koufax because it was nobody hit the ball that much. The story that comes to mind right now is Mickey Mantle with two strikes on him, hitting against Sandy Koufax in the 1963 World Series at Dodger Stadium. Sandy threw him a breaking ball that didn't break, and it being left-handed, Mickey's hitting right-handed. The ball stayed high and away, and then Sandy wrenching his arm around as if he was hurting. And so now Mickey said, now I know he's going to come with that fastball. And he was set for the fastball, and Sandy threw him a curve, and a curveball that was high and outside the strike zone at the last minute. This went right over home plate. Now, I know all that because as a shortstop, I'm watching the signs, and I'm watching the location of the pitch so I could jump should the ball come my way. And Mickey threw the bat up in the air and walked away, and I couldn't hear what he said at the time, but John Roseboro, our catcher, who was my roommate, said, Mickey, how are you supposed to hit that stuff? And just walked away. Sandy Koufax, probably, for me anyway, definitely the greatest pitcher the game has ever known.
I have to say this. I agree with you about Sandy Koufax, and there's a definitive reason for that, and that is if you take a look at today's pitchers, they go six innings, they have a middle relief guy, they have a setup guy, they have a closer. That was not the case. Can you imagine some of the pitchers during that particular era and Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale's, you know, the manager coming out to grab the ball after six innings? I mean, it was a badge of honor, wasn't it, Maury, to go and pitch a complete game?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. You said it so well, Ron. No such thing. You're not going to. Drysdale would not give the manager the ball.
Yes.
He was that kind of a person. Sandy might cry a little bit as he's handing the ball to the manager, but Drysdale would not even give the manager the ball. It's the game is different in that way. I don't like to think that the game has changed on the field as far as executing plays and so forth and so on, how to make the double play and running the bases. But it has changed as far as it's the approach to the game. I'm still with the Dodgers, and I train their players. I mean, high price players, $20 or more million a summer just to play baseball. I would never have told them, but I would have played for free just to play.
Yeah, you know. Following the 1966 season, I have to ask you about this. The Dodgers traded you to the Pittsburgh Pirates, and I know that back in that particular time, you know, players probably expected they'd spend a long time, and you did with the Dodgers. But when you were traded for the very first time in your career, knowing how you had such a passion for baseball and a love for it and a love for the Dodgers, did that hurt you deeply, or how did you deal with that emotionally?
I cried. Oh, yes. You said it so well. From the time I was on that playground in Washington, D.C., when Jerry Pretty had come to our playground, I had already heard about Jackie Robinson. And so I wanted to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers and play for the Dodgers. And would you believe, at 17, they signed me. And I remember telling all my little friends and as I was going to the train station, I turned to them and said, "Hi, bye, y'all. In 2 years' time, I'm going to be in Brooklyn with Jackie." So being a Dodger was my lifetime dream. And I got traded to the Pirates. I cried, you know. But I had it coming because I got a little too big for my britches. We had a postseason tour. We went to Japan, and I left the tour to come home without permission. And I learned my lesson. You just don't do that.
You mentioned about Brooklyn, and certainly that connection for the Dodgers till they moved out to the West Coast was something. And I remember talking with various Brooklyn Dodger players, talking about what it was like at Ebbets Field, the sight, the sound, the smell of that field. Do you have any remembrances of that?
Well, I always wanted to go to Ebbets Field. I only got to see it from the outside. It was down the right field line outside the ballpark. I went to New York one time just to for some reason, and I said, I want to go see Ebbets Field. Can somebody take me? And they took me on this tour. I didn't get to go inside. I can imagine it was a small park, very intimate, and the roar of the crowd was always right on top of you. I always enjoyed that. I never got to see inside of Ebbets Field.
You know, one of the things that I thought about you was that after you retired, you came back, you went on to Montreal, and then you came back and finished out your career with the Dodgers, retiring in 1972. And then you tried your hand at managing with the Seattle Mariners. And I remember when you were named, and I thought after having watched your baseball career, whether that would be a comfortable, and that's the word I want to use, a comfortable transition for Maury Wills. As you reflect back on it now, Maury, and think about it, the reason why you made that decision, tell me a little bit about how comfortable you actually were with the decision to manage the Mariners.
Well, my young adulthood dream was to play baseball for the Brooklyn Dodgers. My adult dream was to be a major league manager, and that came somewhere around 2 to 3 years before my final, before I retired. First of all, I want to touch on why I went to the Pirates. The Dodgers went on a postseason tour to Japan, and I left the tour without permission, and I got a little too big for my britches. And I learned that no matter how good you are as a baseball player, you're not bigger than the game. So when I left the tour without permission, the owner of the Dodgers, Mr. Walter O'Malley, didn't like that, so he traded me to the Pirates. I cried all the way to Pittsburgh. I enjoyed the 2 years I was in Pittsburgh. I thought I had not great years, but good years. But then again, I got caught up in that draft when the league expanded Montreal to Montreal and San Diego, two extra teams. And the manager Gene Mark of the Phillies at the time I was playing drafted me, which was a thrill, honor. But I really didn't want to go to Montreal, but I went there, and it was tough. So halfway through the season, I retired, quit. And the Dodgers asked me to come back, and they were trading for me. Now, just about towards the end of my career, and I thought it was a good career, one of the highlights of my career, I was the MVP of the All-Star game in Washington, D.C., my hometown, in 1963 in front of President John F. Kennedy. I went to the projects to spend the night in the same bedroom and housing that I grew up in with all my little friends over that I played with in the projects, telling them how great it was to be a major league player instead of staying uptown Washington, D.C. with the team in one of the fine hotels. So I got to the ballpark. The team had already arrived, and the security guard wouldn't let me in because he said I was too little to be a ball player, and I ended up being the MVP. So that was my biggest thrill in all of baseball.
Yeah, briefly tell me your thoughts on managing.
Yeah, now the Dodgers had called me back, so I only had one dream left. That was to be a major league manager. And sure enough, with the expansion, of the National League and American League, the president of the Mariners, Dan O'Brien, flew down to Los Angeles and asked me if I could manage that. I said, yes, sir. So he told me he would like to hire me as a manager, and I was all for that. I even went to Mexico and managed during the winter to get some experience, and it just didn't work out. Didn't work out at all. So that's all I can say about it. No need in going into the intricacies of what happened.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know what you mean. Maury, I want to thank you because as a youngster, watching you play baseball was so satisfying to me. You played it, and I could tell just watching you play the game that you had the passion for it, the love for it. Some people just go through the motions. That was not Maury Wills. He played every game with the love that he had for the game when he was just a kid. So I want to thank you very much for sharing your life and your career with us here on Sports Byline.
Thank you, Ron. It's been my pleasure. You brought back some good memories for me, and you brought back some heartaches for me.
Take care, Maury.
All right, Ron. Thank you.
Maury Wills with us again. Shortstop for 14 seasons in Major League Baseball, primarily with the Dodgers, where he won three World Series, 59, 63, 65, and he also played for the Pirates and Expos. And, of course, he was essential to the Dodgers' three championship seasons and is credited with reviving the stolen base as a part of baseball strategy. We continue with more of you in Sports Byline.